From Public Radio International, this is The World. A co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. It's Tuesday, July 5th. I'm Marco Werman. Greek authorities stymie efforts to break Israel's blockade of Gaza, but activists vow to continue their struggle.
We cannot be silent when we see things that are happening, and whether I'm a citizen now or whether I was in the government, I spoke up, and I intend to do it till my dying day.
Also, a new effort to help Somali victims of sexual violence.
Somalia has been pretty much categorically written off, and there's no one in Somalia that's been more written off than Somali women.
And Venezuela turns 200.
PRI's The World is brought to you by the Medtronic Foundation, celebrating the selection of Dr. Dini Zolnaun from the University of North Carolina as the 2011 Society for Women's Health Research Medtronic Prize recipient. More about her contribution to women's health and her work in gynecological pain at swhr.org.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Activists are again trying to breach Israel's blockade of the Gaza Strip. They're trying to sail from Greece and deliver humanitarian aid to the Palestinian territory. So far, they have not succeeded. Greece has banned all boats in the Gaza flotilla from leaving port. Greek authorities cite security concerns given last year's raid by Israeli forces on a similar flotilla. 9 activists were killed in that raid. Former State Department official and retired U.S. Army Colonel Ann Wright is aboard the ship in question, the Audacity of Hope, to participate in the flotilla. Colonel Wright, you were planning to join this flotilla. Why? What are you trying to achieve?
Well, I was on the flotilla last year, the flotilla with over 700 civilian, unarmed citizen activists on 6 ships. The ships were attacked by Israeli commandos. I'm a part of this flotilla. In fact, one of the organizers of the U.S. boat to Gaza, called the Audacity of Hope, because we are challenging U.S. government policies as well as Israeli policies.
Well, given what happened to the Mavi Marmara in the last flotilla and the raid by Israeli security forces, why would you expect any different treatment this time?
You know, it seems like the governments of the world have got this thing backwards. They're accusing the activists of being provocative toward Israel. We're saying that Israel is provocative toward unarmed civilians, that they use violence, gratuitous violence on unarmed civilians that are in the traditional, classic, nonviolent ways challenging policies, as we did in the civil rights movements and everything else.
Fair enough, but you are attempting to breach a country's territorial waters.
Well, whose waters are there? They're Gazan waters. They aren't Israeli waters. Israel is coming out into the Mediterranean, going into other people's waters.
Wherever the international lines are in the water, the fact of the matter is this is a provocative act that you're engaging in. As a former diplomat, do you believe that provocative acts are what ultimately influences policy?
The provocative act is stealing other people's waters and stealing other people's lands and those illegal settlements that they're doing in the West Bank. That's provocative. Citizen activists from around the world are challenging governments who are claiming we're the provocateurs when it's the governments themselves that are the provocateurs.
It sounds like you have a very political message here to deliver, but also this flotilla is supposed to deliver humanitarian aid to the Gaza Strip, and the Greek Foreign Ministry has offered to deliver the aid for you. Why not let them take the aid to Gaza?
I think it would be great for the Greek government to send all sorts of stuff to Gaza. We have 2 cargo ships that are carrying important stuff. It's really a drop in the bucket for what Gaza needs. So the Greek government, I would welcome them to go ahead and create their own flotilla to Gaza and take in as much construction materials,
Why not take your aid, though, Colonel Wright, from the Audacity of Hope ship? Why not let the Greeks take it to Gaza?
Well, because we don't want the Greeks taking our stuff to Gaza. We, as international citizen activists, feel we have the right to challenge this illegal Israeli blockade on Gaza.
Is less humanitarian than it is political to and hoping to provoke some kind of reaction from Israel.
No, we're not. We do not want to. What we want to provoke is Israel really looking at its policies and seeing that its policies are actually dangerous for the security of Israel. That indeed, when you occupy lands, when you put blockades around lands, when you take people's lands in illegal settlements, and you build apartheid walls, that is being provocative.
Colonel Wright, just one final question. I have to say I'm a little surprised. You know, you're a former diplomat and a retired Army colonel, somebody who presumably understands the importance of authority and chains of command. You seem to have gone in a very different direction as an activist.
Well, when I was in the U.S. government, both as a military officer and as a diplomat, when I saw that our government was doing something that I thought was illegal, I always spoke up for it. I resigned in opposition to the war in Iraq. I gave up a career in the U.S. government because I felt that my government was doing illegal things. We cannot be silent when we see things that are happening. And whether I'm a citizen now or whether I was in the government, I spoke up, and I intend to do it until my dying day.
Retired U.S. Army Colonel Anne Wright aboard the Audacity of Hope, which is currently impounded in Greece. Thanks very much for your time.
We appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Terrible things are happening in Somalia. The African country's Transitional Federal Government, or TFG, controls a bit more than half of the capital, Mogadishu. The Al-Qaeda-linked group, Al-Shabaab, controls the other half, along with large swaths of Somalia's south and central regions. The militants have been brutalizing the population. American activist Lisa Shannon is helping create a center in Mogadishu to aid victims of sexual violence. Those victims are many, and their stories are horrifying. Ms. Shannon, who arrived in Nairobi, Kenya today from Mogadishu, told us one of them.
I talked with one girl yesterday who is 17 years old, and her best friend lived next door to her. And a member of Shabaab showed up at her house wanting to marry her, and her father refused. So they killed her father, and one day the girl that I spoke with was at home and heard a commotion out front. She walked out front, and they were digging a hole, and they proceeded to drag her best friend out and stone her to death right in front of their house and then bury her in the hole. This girl, just last month, had a member of Shabaab follow her home to her hut and pushed her inside. Five men followed, and they gang-raped her in front of her younger brothers and sisters. And what she talked about is just constant fear. She's scared to leave her house. She's scared to sleep at night. She's scared to walk outside to use the bathroom because she's afraid that she'll be attacked.
So what kind of support does Al-Shabaab have from the general public in Somalia if these things are happening under their kind of rule, as it were?
And if anyone objects, they're basically killed, just like these girls' fathers were. So people are living in a state of complete terror. I mean, we were supposed to go to Mogadishu 2 weeks ago, but we had to cancel because there were multiple suicide bombings inside Mogadishu. And that's the safe area. So people are under complete Shabaab control. There is no outlet. So for people to be able to come into the TFG-controlled area and actually find a kind of sanctuary, which we aim to create, is really something exceptional.
And describe that center. I mean, it just sounds so chaotic and so violent in Somalia that it's hard to imagine that a project could address some of this.
I expected going in that the women would be very reserved and that it would be hard to break down some of those barriers. But in fact, that wasn't the case at all. They were smiling and laughing. We gave them letters from American women, and they were incredibly touched by that. It has the feeling of a kind of sanctuary there, and that was a surprise to me.
Lisa Shannon, one part of this project that perhaps addresses some of the security issues is, it's a little surprising. You're setting up a rape crisis hotline. I mean, I'm surprised to hear that Somali women have access to cell phones.
I would not have imagined that there were active cell networks. But in fact, strangely, one area of the Somali economy that has boomed is technology and networks. So in fact, it's very appropriate also because women then can access. The idea is they'll be able to call the line and they can provide counseling over the phone, transport to the center, a meal. They're given a letter from someone, you know, abroad who cares about them, then provided emergency grants perhaps to move to a more secure area. In fact, the girl that I talked about is going to be the first recipient of the program, and we're looking into what we can do for her right now in terms of moving her away from the site of the attack so that she doesn't have to see these guys every single day, but also vocational skills for women so that they're able to build a life in an area that hopefully is slightly more secure outside of the Al-Shabaab area and have a chance to network with other women who have lived through it. That was one of the things that I saw there, too, is that the women really had developed a community and were supporting each other in a way that was very striking.
Is it working?
You know, you have to think about the alternative, and I think this is what drove my interest in Somalia. I've been haunted by it for years, this sense that in the international community, we make decisions all the time about where it is worth investment and where it is not worth investment. And the thing that haunted me is this sense that since the early 90s, Somalia has been pretty much categorically written off. And there's no one in Somalia that's been more written off than Somali women.
Lisa Shannon is working to create a lifeline for victims of sexual violence in Somalia. You can see a slideshow of her work at theworld.org. The people of another African nation, Sudan, are also war-weary. A two-decades-long civil war there finally came to an end in 2005. A comprehensive peace agreement not only stopped the fighting, it called for a referendum for people in southern Sudan to vote on independence. They did that 6 months ago, and so this weekend, Sudan is set to split in two. A priority for the new nation of southern Sudan will be to build an education system. The BBC's Fergus Nicol reports from Malakal.
This is St. Peter's Episcopal Church School. The primary kids there enjoying an English class. Over on the other side of the big courtyard, there's an Arabic class going on. We'll talk to some of the secondary students over there in just a minute. It's interesting that the church has put this all together with international help just in the last 6 years since the Comprehensive Peace Agreement was signed. And it's a fee-paying school. The parents contribute 270 Sudanese pounds a year. That's about $95. Doesn't sound much to many listeners, probably, but for a lot of families in Malakal, it is a great deal of money. That pays the teachers, and they work extremely hard.
It is not here.
It is not here.
Where is the tree?
Where is the tree?
It is not
okay,
here.
Okay, it's me, Fergus. وعندنا سؤالين بالنسبة للاستقلال كلام عربي ما كويس. So we've interrupted the second year class to ask some of the students here a few questions about their hopes for independence, their hopes for the future. Okay, we've got a young lad here. It's going to come up. What would you like to say?
Okay. Yes, my name is Stuart John. أنا طبعا بنتكلم.
We are hoping that the independence will bring us good. Our people who are just suffering, the oppression we got from the north, we will forget it, and the development will take place. So I encourage my colleagues to be able to work hard so that we can build our nation.
I've come from the north and I've seen a lot of suffering, and I'm happy to be back. And I want to encourage all of you to work hard so we will build our new nation. Some of you will become doctors, engineers, professionals, and you will help yourself and your family and the nation. So let us forget about playing around and let's commit ourselves to learning.
There it is.
My name is Hilary Garang Deng Awer. The children we are teaching, they are different from the children from our time. They have no culture. They have culture of war. And if we are not careful, tell them the right thing, then we are going to lose part of them.
Now we are going to sing a song, okay?
Yes.
Sudan, our country, okay?
The BBC's Fergus Nicol reporting from Malakal in southern Sudan. You can watch and listen to a local choir sing southern Sudan's national anthem at theworld.org. This is PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Medtronic. leveraging products, people, partnerships, and philanthropy to help change the way the world addresses the global epidemic of chronic diseases such as diabetes and heart disease. More about Medtronic's chronic disease commitment at Medtronic.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Attitudes towards smoking have changed a bit since 1586. Here's what an English visitor to America wrote that year after he observed some Indian smokers. Their bodies, he commented, are notably preserved in health and know not many grievous diseases, wherewithal we in England are oftentimes afflicted. Well, the graphic new warning labels that will appear on packages of cigarettes next year in the U.S. suggest otherwise, and in Iceland, officials are planning even more draconian measures.
We are hoping for minimizing the tobacco sales to about zero.
Sif Fritleifsdottir is sponsoring an anti-smoking measure in the Icelandic parliament. The legislation would ban the sale of tobacco, except at a pharmacy. You'd need a medical certificate to get your nicotine fix, and don't even think of smoking if you're under 20 years old. Fritleifsdottir says society has an obligation to protect young people from themselves.
When the young people are starting to smoke, it's not a kind of an informed decision, and they get addicted very, very fast, so we should protect them. It's an obligation for us.
It doesn't seem to be much of an obligation in other parts of the world. In a moment, we'll head to Indonesia, where cigarette companies market their product aggressively, and the government doesn't seem to mind at all. But first, we go to Russia, where Jessica Gallagher tells us that an anti-smoking push is up against a pro-smoking culture.
Yelena Zlatustovskaya sits in a popular Moscow restaurant. She looks cool, sleek, and sexy, holding an ultra-slim cigarette between her fingers. At least that's what marketing wizards would have you think. And Zlatutovskaya should know. She's a bigwig at the Moscow office of PR firm Edelman.
Smoking is quite a traditional thing in Russia. And this is really is a problem for Russia. A lot of people accustomed to smoke very cheap cigarettes with a low quality of tobacco.
And accustomed they are. A World Health Organization study puts Russia among one of the smokiest nations in the world, with more smokers per capita than Indonesia or China. And according to Zlatustovskaya, advertisers are using every weapon in their arsenal to get even more smokers. It's not unusual to see scantily clad young women standing on some of the city's most popular streets, like Tverskaya, offering cigarettes to lure people in.
Sampling is very popular. So you're just walking around the street, and the girl near the metro station comes to you and said, okay, we have new cigarettes. And I think that they will pay a lot of attention to that kind of promotions.
That type of street-level promotion seems to be doing the trick. In 2009, Russia was the largest market worldwide for slim, ultra-slim cigarettes, which are generally targeted towards young women. These types of cigarettes often feature flowers on their packaging. Aromatic cigarettes are also the latest, greatest thing. One of Philip Morris's brands, Virginia Slim's Uno, in both black and white, is meant to fit a woman's mood. Ads feature hip, sophisticated, model-type-looking women on the go. According to Philip Morris, their Slim cigarette sales jumped, get this, 91% from 2006 to 2009. Those numbers have embarrassed the Kremlin. Russia has pledged to cut the numbers of its smokers by up to 15% by 2050. The government has also banned cigarette ads on television and has introduced warning labels on cigarette packages that read, "Smoking kills." and that smoking can also cause heart attacks, strokes, death, and impotence, among other things. The WHO wants Russia to do more, as other countries have done, like put graphic images of smoke-ravaged lungs on cigarette packages. What does PR director Zlatutovskaya think about the possibility of that happening? She rolls her eyes.
I don't think they would do that. They get very good taxes from that. So I don't think they will say, okay, we will care about our population. We need them to be healthy. We'll do whatever just to keep them healthy. No, I don't believe in that.
Meanwhile, Russia's health minister, Tatiana Golikova, says the former Soviet Union has to do everything possible to combat the country's high smoking rates. So she's all for the gloomy pictures. For The World, I'm Jessica Gallagher in Moscow.
On the other hand, you won't find health officials in Indonesia doing very much at all to combat high smoking rates. Sandy Hausman visited the Southeast Asian country as part of the International Journalism Project Fellowship.
When you step out of the international airport in Jakarta, it seems impossible that this could be Marlboro country. It's oppressively hot and humid. Traffic is bumper to bumper, and the air is barely breathable. But as you drive into town, you can't miss the message. Half of all billboards in this country promote cigarettes. Flip on the TV and you might catch an ad in which a guy rides his motorcycle to the top of a volcano. Or one in which a construction worker, through superhuman stunts, prevents a serious accident. By law, they can't show cigarettes, but that's what both are advertising, with brands getting a prominent mention. Concerts and sporting events are often sponsored by tobacco companies, and fans take note. 18-year-old Ravio and 21-year-old Widya are students at the University of Jakarta.
When they see their idols or their favorite artists smoke in their movies or in their video clips, it just triggers them to try to smoke, because if I smoke, then I will be the same as my idols.
You are cool when you smoke, for some people.
In fact, a 2008 report showed nearly a third of Indonesians age 10 and above smoke an average of 12 cigarettes a day. It's an easy habit to acquire, with cigarettes costing less than a dollar a pack or 10 cents a piece. Indonesia chooses not to impose high taxes on cigarettes, a move that would almost certainly decrease sales. Then there's the culture.
If you don't have cigarette, I have cigarette, I can offer you, I can give you. When you have a function, like funeral or wedding ceremony, so as a host, you have to serve not only food and drink, but also cigarette.
Dr. Yayi Suryoprabhandari is on the public health faculty of Gajah Mada University. She says large chain stores won't sell cigarettes to kids under 18. But small shops are another matter.
The big supermarket that have regulation that they not sell to under 18. But if you go to the small kiosk, so you can buy, even 5 years old, they can buy.
Early attempts to pass stricter laws have met with strong opposition. Often politicians cite the need to protect tobacco farmers, and thousands of workers, mostly women, employed to hand-roll Indonesia's famed clove-studded smokes. Cigarettes are an important source of tax revenue, and there's one other factor working in tobacco's favor. Since 2008, Marcus has worked as a counselor in a Central Java quit-smoking clinic. Over those 3 years, he's seen just 114 people.
Many people ask whether there is a medicine that he can, you know, drink and then suddenly stop smoking.
In fact, there is not. Dr. Yayi says the makers of nicotine gum and patches see Indonesia as a poor country, not a lucrative market.
15 years ago, they tried to sell in Indonesia, but the market is not very good, so they withdraw.
On the international front, Indonesia is one of only 3 countries that refused to ratify the World Health Organization's Framework Convention on Tobacco Control, a document that would end cigarette advertising, promotions, and sponsorships. The country does require cigarette packs to carry labels that warn of medical risks, including impotence, and it's approved disturbing photographs of other health consequences to appear on packages even before the U.S. For The World, I'm Sandy Hausman in Jakarta.
News headlines from around the world are next on PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Marco Werman. Ahead, a Japanese-American musician was hesitant about touring Japan, but then a fan sent her this message.
Artists are avoiding Japan like the plague. Hearing something like that come from a Japanese person was very painful to hear, but it made me realize what they're going through and how hurtful that could be.
PRI's The World is brought to you by the Medtronic Foundation, celebrating the selection of Dr. Dini Solnaun from the University of North Carolina as the 2011 Society for Women's Health Research Medtronic Prize recipient. More about her contribution to women's health and her work in gynecological pain at swhr.org.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. Venezuelans are celebrating their independence today on the 5th of July. It's the 200-year anniversary of Venezuela's Declaration of Independence from Spain. The festivities began a day early for thousands of Venezuelans. They gave President Hugo Chavez a hero's welcome as he returned from Cuba, where he was getting medical treatment. Now, Chavez is not universally loved in Venezuela. We'll hear more about his mixed record as president in a moment. But first, we go to the BBC's Sarah Granger in Caracas. Sarah, you've been out on the streets of Caracas. What was the atmosphere like?
Well, down on Los Próceres, which is a big pedestrianized boulevard, there are military marches going on, and it's absolutely filled with thousands of people, most of them dressed in red, which shows their allegiance to the Socialist Party of President Chavez. Many of them there not just celebrating Independence Day and the bicentenary, but celebrating the fact that the president came back to the country yesterday. And a jubilant mood. The government's pulled out all the stops for this celebration. They started off the march with jets through the skies of Caracas, streaming coloured smoke in the colours of the Venezuelan flag, red, yellow and blue. And President Chavez himself began the march, but from the presidential palace on a video link. He wasn't actually there present himself.
And that jubilant mood you described, Sarah, across Caracas, is that duplicated everywhere?
Obviously, if you're of a certain political persuasion, if you back the president and you back the Socialist Party, then this really is a huge celebration. And the government's been planning this for months and months. They've really gone to some trouble to celebrate this bicentenary. And it's for them, it's really a political celebration as much as a celebration for the country. I think anyone who is a supporter of the opposition probably isn't enjoying these festivities. So I think it's very much split on political lines. And I think it's very much a political celebration.
Now, Hugo Chavez has only just returned to Venezuela from Cuba. What's been the reaction there so far to his return and to the news that he had surgery in Cuba as part of his treatment for cancer?
I think the reaction yesterday when he first arrived back and first addressed the public amongst his supporters was one of jubilation and delight. He seemed back to his old self, embracing the public. He loved being out there and watching these thousands of people who'd come to see him speak. That contrasted very sharply with the man that we saw delivering the message last week that he'd been treated for cancer. He looked himself very apologetic and almost quite scared when he gave that announcement. And I think that made a lot of people here quite worried. And by coming back the day before Independence Day and coming out and talking to the public, he's trying to ease people's fears about his ability to continue. But obviously the fact that he's not present physically at today's marches shows that he is still having treatment, and we'll have to wait and see over the next weeks and months how he responds to treatment and how he responds to having to work at the same time.
The BBC's Sarah Granger in Caracas, thanks very much indeed.
Thank you.
Hugo Chavez was first elected president of Venezuela back in 1998. He came to power vowing to use the country's oil wealth to improve the lives of its poorest citizens. By some accounts, he's delivering. Living standards are improving in Venezuela, but the president's critics say Chavez is falling short of his own rhetoric. John Otis sent us this report from Caracas.
Entonces, ¿qué dice ahí?
At a Caracas elementary school, Education Minister Marianne Hansen urges a first grader to read aloud from the screen of a new laptop computer. To improve computer literacy, Hansen tells me, the Chavez government is giving away nearly 2 million laptops to primary school students. We are preparing kids for the challenges of new technologies, the minister says. Free computers are part of a broader government campaign to make education more accessible, and it's working. Enrollment at primary schools has jumped 50% over the past decade. University attendance has tripled. In fact, government statistics on health, education, and economic development point to a substantial, if not great, leap forward. All this comes after Venezuela registered one of the world's worst economic declines between 1970 and 1998, the year Chavez was elected. Under Chavez, unemployment and poverty have been cut by half. Infant mortality is falling. New clinics and hospitals are going up. That's Chavez, before his own medical emergency, talking with his health minister on TV about plans to build 17 hospitals and maternity wards in Venezuela. But for all the positive data, Venezuela is rarely held up as a model for development, largely because Chavez himself is so controversial. Critics view Chavez as a populist demagogue. They dismiss his social welfare programs as cynical maneuvers to win over the masses and remain in power. They also claim that soaring street crime, frequent power outages, and one of the highest rates of inflation in Latin America have wiped out some of the gains.
Nosotros teníamos 30 años sin recibir.
Luis Pedro España, a development expert at Catholic University in Caracas, says Chavez has simply lucked out by presiding over Venezuela's first oil boom in 30 years and record-high petroleum prices.
Sin esa renta petrolera, los indicadores serían muy diferentes.
Without all the oil income, living standards would be much different. To be honest, Venezuelans have to admit that this has been like winning the lottery.
That's why España calls the changes under Chavez superficial rather than structural. For example, the jobless rate has dropped, partly because the government has nearly doubled the number of state workers. Doctors and nurses have been stationed in poor barrios to serve as first responders, but patients who need major surgery must often rely on run-down public hospitals that lack medicine and equipment. At a government store that sells subsidized food, I meet orthodontist Rosalba Mogollon. She tells me her office at a nearby public hospital lacks an air compressor. Mogollon can't treat her patients, so she's out buying groceries. Not far from the grocery store sits a community center where the government's largesse includes a large dose of political ideology. At the center, people get medical checkups and attend workshops on how to defend the Chavez revolution. Still, deeply flawed government is nothing new for Venezuela, where several recent presidents have been vilified for corruption and mishandling the economy. What is new is that Chavez has made the needs of the poor a high-profile and lasting priority. As they prepare for presidential elections next year, even opposition politicians are now borrowing a page from the Chavez playbook, says pollster Luis Vicente León.
Everybody's supporting social programs because we realize that we need to help these people. I think this is the best thing that Chavez has done in Venezuela in these 12 years.
For The World, I'm John Otis, Caracas.
Black coal figures in today's GeoQuiz. Coal is mined in more than 100 countries and on all continents except Antarctica. Major coal deposits are found from the Appalachian Mountains all the way down to the southern Andes, as well as throughout India, Siberia, and other parts of Asia. Mongolia has just announced plans to start a major coal mining project in the Gobi Desert. But the question for today's quiz is simple. Who are the world's top coal producers? We're looking for the top three coal mining countries in the world. When we come back with the answer, we'll talk coal and hear about a somewhat surprising new study. It says pollution from Asia's coal-fired power plants may actually have slowed down global warming. We'll be back with the answer in a minute. The Central Asian nation of Kyrgyzstan is still recovering from a turbulent 2010. A bloody revolt ousted its president in April of last year. Then in June, ethnic violence in the south left more than 400 people dead. One year later, Kyrgyzstan is moving forward from those terrible times. The country has scheduled a presidential election in October. It's part of a plan to make Kyrgyzstan more democratic than its authoritarian neighbors. But Lily Jamali reports from Osh that Kyrgyzstan's violent past remains all too present today.
Adina has vivid memories of the violence that gripped southern Kyrgyzstan last year. Her teenage son was shot several times. He was hospitalized for days before Adina found him.
His condition was very bad. He was badly wounded. At first, I didn't recognize him.
Adina is an ethnic Uzbek from a majority Uzbek neighborhood in Osh. Most ethnic Uzbeks here live in temporary structures. Kyrgyz mobs destroyed their homes during the ethnic violence in southern Kyrgyzstan last year. Adina lives in limbo, and she seems to have given up hope.
I don't have the will to live. After something like this, you lose interest in everything.
Across town is an ethnic Kyrgyz neighborhood. A Kyrgyz grandmother named Sharipa Abdikarimova is also living in a temporary shelter. Abdikarimova lost her home last year, too, to an Uzbek mob.
I want peace, and I hope nothing like that happens again.
Different narratives have emerged to explain how what people here call the June events began. An independent international commission found that both sides committed acts of violence, but most of the victims were Uzbek. The commission also uncovered evidence that Kyrgyz law enforcement at times participated in the attacks. The release of the commission's final report prompted the parliament to ban the report's lead author, a Finnish politician, from entering Kyrgyzstan. That decision and others have led to cynicism about the government's handling of the aftermath of last year's ethnic violence. Ule Solvang is a researcher with Human Rights Watch. He says Kyrgyz authorities have not done their job.
There has been a failure to provide justice for the victims, and that failure is part of what prolongs the tensions between the Kyrgyz and the Uzbeks.
Rebuilding has begun here in Osh, but the charred remains of many homes and shops still mar the city. A Kyrgyz woman named Talay Bubu lost her stand at the bazaar when a mob overran it.
They broke into my stall, and they burned it down.
Talay Bubu recently met a group of women, Kyrgyz and Uzbek, in similar situations. They've formed a group that provides legal help to female entrepreneurs. Such partnerships offer some hope for the future, but old attitudes remain. Many Kyrgyz fear that ethnic Uzbeks in southern Kyrgyzstan want to secede, and Uzbeks still feel marginalized by the ethnic Kyrgyz-dominated government. Eric McGlinchey of George Mason University says reconciliation can only come when that changes.
There has to be some kind of, greater incorporation of the Uzbek population in particular into the political structures and the military and the police structures of southern Kyrgyzstan if Kyrgyzstan is going to get beyond this underlying ethnic divide that they now have.
Meanwhile, Kyrgyzstan is moving closer to becoming Central Asia's first parliamentary democracy. The United States backs the new model, but Kyrgyzstan's former master, Russia, opposes it. There are American and Russian military air bases in Kyrgyzstan, and in addition to the ethnic rivalries here, there may also be a nascent Islamic militant movement. The U.S. certainly doesn't want to see a failed state here. For The World, I'm Lily Jamali in Osh, Kyrgyzstan.
Time's up on today's GeoQuiz. We asked for the names of the top three coal producers in the world. India is number three. Number two is the U.S. And the largest coal producer is China. And this probably won't surprise you. China is also the world's largest user of coal. And that leads to another question. What's the impact of burning all that coal on the global climate? If you've heard that it's helping warm up the atmosphere, you're right. China's coal use has helped it become the biggest annual emitter of greenhouse gas pollution. But a new study out this week shows that the picture is a little more complicated. It turns out that all that coal smoke is also helping to cool the atmosphere. We've asked our environment editor Peter Thompson to help us make sense of this news. Peter, what's going on here? How can coal emissions from China be both warming and cooling the atmosphere at the same time?
Well, Marco, it's because burning coal produces a lot of different kinds of stuff, and
All of these have different effects on the environment. The two things we're interested in here in terms of their impact on global warming are carbon dioxide and sulfur dioxide. CO2, of course, is that gas we've all heard so much about over the recent years. It helps trap the sun's radiation and warm the planet up. That's undoubtedly happening. There's no question that huge amounts of CO2 are being produced by Chinese power plants and other industry and are helping trap more heat and contributing to climate change.
Right, so that's CO2. What about sulfur dioxide? How does that come into play?
Well, it has the opposite effect. Its release from coal smoke is something called aerosols. These are tiny particles or drops that float up into the atmosphere. And the key here is that they reflect sunlight back into space, and that helps cool the atmosphere. And it turns out that the huge amount of sulfur being released from China's coal plants in the last 10 years or so is actually helping to counteract the warming effect of all that carbon dioxide. It's called masking. And the finding is part of a study published this week in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences here in the U.S. Essentially, the study found that without all that sulfur, the huge increase in China's coal pollution would be having an even bigger impact on the global climate.
What is the take-home message here? Is there a silver lining to that big dark cloud of Chinese coal smoke?
Well, I'm afraid not. There are a couple of reasons for that. One is that CO2 stays active in the atmosphere for centuries, but sulfur aerosols wash out relatively quickly. So when the cooling effect of the aerosols is over, we'll still be stuck with the warming effect of the CO2 for a very long time. More important than that, though, is that sulfur is also a nasty pollutant in its own right. It causes acid rain. It also causes big health problems in people. A few decades ago, Western countries went to great lengths to get rid of sulfur emissions by passing laws like the Clean Air Act here in the U.S. The pressure is on in China to get rid of sulfur emissions there as well. So, in all likelihood, before long, we'll see a drop in sulfur emissions in China and a drop in that masking effect. And that means the effect of all that CO2 is really going to take off. And that's really bad news for the climate.
The World's Environment Editor, Peter Thompson, thanks very much.
Thank you, Marco.
Just ahead, a Japanese anti-nuke reggae singer who has no fear for atomic energy on PRI. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. An earthquake of preliminary magnitude 5.4 jolted western Japan today. The quake caused strong shaking south of Japan's third largest city, Osaka. There were no immediate reports of casualties or damages, and no tsunami warning was issued. Still, it was an unsettling reminder of the earthquake and tsunami that hit Japan on March 11th. That double catastrophe devastated areas along the Pacific coast in northern Japan, and it triggered the world's worst nuclear crisis since Chernobyl 25 years ago. Engineers are still struggling to bring the reactors under control. The ongoing crisis has traumatized many Japanese. Some have found solace in the messages of their favorite musicians. Japanese-American singer-songwriter Emmy Meyer toured Japan last month, and she shared the bill with some of those artists. Meyer says she initially had reservations about going.
I was definitely very conflicted, especially going back to tour there. At first, it wasn't an easy decision, considering the risks of radiation aftershocks, but it really made me realize the part of me that is Japanese, especially receiving emails from friends or family or fans in Japanese that really spoke to me emotionally.
Like what? Do you remember an example?
Artists are avoiding Japan like the plague. Hearing something like that come from a Japanese person was very painful to hear, but it made me realize what they're going through. And I tried to imagine what it would be like living there right now. And many people don't have the option to leave, but when some of your closest friends or artists you really admire choose not to come, how hurtful that could be.
Mm. There's a song on your new album, Suitcase of Stones. The song is called Yesterday's Rain. And just to establish who you are as a musician, I'd like our listeners to hear this.
As so we move on to today.
A song called Yesterday's Rain by Emmy Meyer. Emmy, the song was recorded before March 11th, but there are some parallels to what's been happening in Japan in your lyrics, aren't there?
Yes. Playing this song at performances right now was very meaningful, just to realize that even if you go through something very hard, to stay upbeat and look towards the brighter day that will be coming.
And when you were in Japan playing the song, playing those gigs, you met some Japanese artists who kind of impressed you as people who had things to get off their chests about what's going on. One of them is a band called Soul Flower Union. What are they up to?
Yes, well, I actually met the guitarist who has collaborated with Soul Flower Union. His name's Hiroshi Yamada. And he has been really moved to action by this recent tragedy. And so he's gone to Fukushima. I had the opportunity to perform with him in Yaizu, which is near Fuji, and he performed this song, Mangetsu no Yube, just guitar and himself at the very end of his set, and something about it really spoke to me. So I asked my bandmates afterwards, what was that song and why were people reacting so strongly? People were really on the verge of tears, and they told me that this was a song, Mangetsu no Yube, or Last Night's Full Moon. Hiroshi Yamada and Soul Flower Union wrote this song together after the 1995 Kobe earthquake. While the verses are very sad, it's talking about how everything's destroyed, everything is so sad that there's nothing you can do but laugh. The chorus is very, very hopeful about people kind of going through this hard time together, but supporting each other.
Now, Hiroshi Yamada's song has dark verses with kind of uplifting choruses. This other band that you met, or rather artist, Papa Yuji, is a reggae singer, so a lot of his music is all upbeat. May seem odd that there's a huge reggae scene in Japan, but there is. Tell me about Papa Yuji. He's taking on this nuclear crisis. What's he saying in his song?
Yes, well, I performed at the same festival as him in Shizuoka, and he's been active in the reggae scene for over 20 years now in Japan. He delayed the release of his album for a month so that he could include this new song, Respect Japanese.
And what's he saying?
He's saying things like media and politicians, a government we can't trust, but if the people join forces and our hearts link together, our children's faces will turn into a brighter energy, energy that does not rely on nuclear power. And so he's really kind of taking on the nuclear energy issue and saying, you know, for the sake of our children, right now is the time when people have to join forces and realize this is not the path that we want to take.
How did people in the audience respond to the sentiments?
It was a reggae concert, so people were being very upbeat and relaxed. And also in reggae, I think there's a tradition of including very loaded political statements in the guise of uplifting music. And it was nice for all the families to hear that.
Let's go out, Emmy, with another one of your songs. This is from a previous album of yours that came out in 2010. It's called Passport. Tell us about the song on here that you think, you know, resonated maybe perhaps in a surprising way, a way that you did not expect with Japanese listeners when you were in Japan?
Well, this is titled Noborizaka, and it means the uphill climb, and I co-wrote this song with another artist, Shingo Too, from Japan. And the chorus really resonated. It's talking about the more hills you climb, the stronger you get. And I think especially, you know, in the wake of this disaster and so many things that are still coming up, it's really important for people to feel like they're going through this, but it might make them realize, you know, how important it is to spend time with each other or to speak up and just become stronger. And I think people reacted strongly to this song right now.
Emmy Meyer's new album is called Suitcase of Stones. She joined us from KUOW in Seattle. Emmy, very nice to speak with you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you for having me.
Watch a video of another Emmy Meyer song. It's at theworld.org. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH Boston, supported in part by Nan and Bill Harris, committed to supporting objective, unbiased reporting on national and international issues. The WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can, and the Candida Fund, furthering the values that contribute to a healthy planet.
PRI, Public Radio International.